Charles Moore was a minister in Texas who set himself on fire to protest racism in his community. Today, we'll hear about a new film exploring how his death affected his town. Plus, the UIC women's gymnastics team won a conference championship, but their program is still getting cut. In this March Madness season, how colleges prioritize certain sports. And Southern Illinois is home to the state's only national forest. This year, Shawnee National Forest turns 80 years old.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, UIC is cutting its gymnastics programs. What does this say about the state of collegiate sports? And Shawnee National Forest turns 80 years old this year. We learn about the origins of Illinois' only national forest. But first, on June 23rd in 2014, a Methodist minister named Charles Moore set himself on fire in a Dollar General parking lot of his hometown in Grand Saline, Texas. The reasons why he did that remain somewhat of a mystery, one that filmmakers Joel Fendelman and James Chase Sanchez try to answer in their documentary, Man on Fire.
What's that? 911.
This is Angie at the Dollar General.
In what city?
At Grant Saline, and the man's on fire out in the parking lot.
The man is on fire?
Yes, a man just set himself on fire.
Joel and James are in Central Illinois this week for a screening of the documentary, which has also appeared on PBS's Independent Lens. You can also find it online at manonfirefilm.com. They stopped by our studios before their event. Hi, guys. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
So first, I just wanted to ask you, I didn't know that much about this story, that he was a minister and this was an attempt to have a public call to repent for the racism that he saw, particular treatment of African-Americans in his town. James, this is your hometown, so I imagine you knew about this when this happened.
Yeah, I lived in Fort Worth, which is about 2 hours from Grand Saline, and I immediately heard about it on social media, but the conversation wasn't so much about why he did it. It was just that someone was quote-unquote crazy and had lit themselves on fire. And then about 2 days later, I contacted the editor at the Grand Saline Sun newspaper and was trying to find out more information. And I got the letter that Charles Moore left on his car windshield titled, "Oh, Grand Saline, Repent of Your Racism." And immediately I read the letter, and it reminded me so much of my upbringing in Grand Saline as a person of color. And I kind of got chills because Charles Moore was talking about these experiences that he had with the KKK and lynchings in the 1940s and 50s. And these were stories that I remember hearing quite vividly in the early 2000s growing up there. And so I immediately felt this instant connection with Charles Moore and knew I needed to do a project on him.
Joel, how did you hear about this?
Well, I heard about it through a mutual friend that Chase and I had who connected me with James. And then I read this article by Michael Hall in the Texas Monthly, who did a very long feature about it. But I was living in Austin, Texas at the time and just moved there actually a few months after this happened, but had not heard about it until a year later when I was turned on to Chase and this article. And it was really kind of punched in the gut hearing about what Charles Moore did and the reasons for why he did this and these questions of, well, what am I doing in this world to make this place a better place? And here's this man who set himself on fire to bring social justice. And that really got me hooked. And so,
James, you mentioned your upbringing, and I wanted to just ask you if you could first tell us a little bit about Grand Saline. We learn a lot about Grand Saline if you watch the documentary about the town, about how big it is, but also not just about its present, but its past. What was it like to grow up there? So you're Latino?
Yeah.
What's the demographic makeup of
sure.
the town? Because it sounds like there's really no black people
yeah,
in the town.
Zero black people live in town. I think when I grew up there, there was no black people live in town. I think the 2010 census says that there are 10 black people. I think a few of them are children who are mixed race, but there are no black families that I know of who live in town. And it's just interesting, when you grow up in East Texas, in this town in particular, these racism was so common in everyday life that you just think that's how the world exists. And so the town was very racist against black people. The N-word was used all the time. I remember, like, when we would play black people in sports, there'd be people saying, like, look at these monkeys walking around on their hind legs. It was so common. But
people would say that, like, just for a high school game?
Yeah, just it was very common for high schoolers to have these conversations. But it wasn't just high schoolers. There were elders in the community who perpetuated this racism.
And just to be clear, this was when you were growing up. So this was like 15 years, like 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, I graduated in 2006.
Okay,
so,
10 years ago.
Yeah, and there's so many stories about that. Like, my nickname in high school was Wetback and Beaner. And there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, there was a small Latino population, but, you know, we didn't have any authority in this space. But there are also things that, as a community, was okay. And I think one of them that really stands out to me is at the end of pep rallies for the football game, for the football team before our games, we'd come together in a high school gym, and our slogan was, "We're all right because we're all white." I'm not white. I didn't fit that bill. And that always stuck out to me, not because kids were saying this, but because it was said in front of coaches and elders in the community who could clearly hear this but would never say anything about it. And once I moved away from Grant Saline, I realized, look how racist this environment is. And that has always stuck with me since I moved away. And I think when Charles Moore set himself on fire, I knew this would be a perfect vehicle to further explore the racism in my hometown.
And so I wanted to play some clips. You guys talked to a lot of different people for this. And this is actually the city administrator, Rex White. And this is his response when you asked him about racism in Grand Saline.
Grand Saline holding some kind of racism or racist idea as a community, that doesn't exist. And I don't think we have to continue to talk about that. If you're not careful, it'll stir all that up again and it'll be perpetuated again. And that's not something we want to happen, because it needs to go away. And it goes away because the good people of Grand Saline do not perpetuate it. It's talked about far less here than it might be in other places.
That's Rex White, the city administrator for Grand Saline, and that's a clip from Man on Fire. We're talking about this documentary with producer James Chase Sanchez and director Joel Fendelman, who are in studio with me here in Urbana. So, guys, there's a lot in there, right? And I wanted to wonder if we can just kind of talk a little bit about, first of all, not just his reaction, but I think also, and I think this is particularly relevant in today's America, using the word racism. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So first, I just wonder, when Rex White said that to him, James, were you surprised after you? So you're sort of, you're contrasting what you've just shared of your personal experience, yeah, and then hearing him say, no, people are good. And I've heard people say this. I've heard people say this everywhere. I've heard people say this in Illinois. Like, we're good people, so we can't be racist.
Yeah. I think before even answering that, a little context is needed in that. It took Rex, this was probably the third try to get Rex on film, and he didn't come on film until he talked to the city council and the lawyer in the town, and they decided they should have someone come on film because it would be best for them as the city. And so I just took my personal experiences are totally different from Rex's. The people in the town absolutely talk about this all the time. And it just shows me this idea again about how white people try to deflect from any real conversation. There are major racial problems in Grant Saline, but the easier thing to do is to not talk about it and just say, like, this is old, this is history, we don't have to talk about these issues anymore. When in reality, there are still many people in the town who hold very racist sentiments and very explicit and implicit forms.
And Joel, so I wanted to ask you about that as well. One thing we've talked about occasionally here on the 21st is Illinois' history of having sundown towns. And we've talked about how many sundown towns there were across Illinois. And for people who aren't familiar, it's basically a town where it was either illegal or unsafe for black people to be there after dark. And this was Grant Saline was a sundown town.
Well, we weren't able to actually confirm.
Because that's another part. There was actually a sign, though.
Well, that's one of the things. I mean, there were stories of a sign, and I think lots of evidence that shows there probably was a sign, but we never were actually able to find an actual sign. So it becomes this hearsay. Like, everyone says, well, I knew someone who saw a sign. Or we have the one person, Chet, on camera who says, someone I worked with had a sign. It's probably in his game room
somewhere.
And
what did the sign say?
Well, it'd say something like,
don't let the sun set on your black ass.
Yeah, something like that. Or something worse. On the entrance and exit to the...
To the town. Okay.
But like you're saying, like something... I mean, I'd never heard of this. I grew up in Miami in a city. I'm a city boy. So coming out to Texas and to East Texas was a whole nother world. So then learning about this idea of sundown towns, like, oh, yeah, that's a southern thing, right? But no, it's not. You come out to Illinois in the north, sundown towns were everywhere. And there's a great book, James Lowen, called Sundown
Towns. Yeah, he's actually been on, James has been on the 21st talking about his research on sundown towns. So let me ask you, when you guys were working on this, did you worry at all about reinforcing stereotypes of the South? Or having viewers think, like, this is what all of Texas is like if you are taking a snapshot of this one town and their history?
It's a really good question. I don't think we've been asked that before. I would say there's always a fear of essentializing this town as far as we're showing some people. And to be honest, we didn't put in, like, all the worst things that we heard. There were definitely worse things that didn't make it into the film that we actively chose not to put in because we thought it sensationalized it too much. And a lot of the racism in the community is a lot more on this covert level. So I don't know if I feared essentialization of them, of being pegged as, look at Grant Saline, the most racist town, or this is indicative of the South or Texas in general. And I think how I know that's true is that we've done a fair amount of screenings, and every time after a screening, especially in different places from the South, someone comes up to me and will say, have you ever heard of Blinken Blake, Ohio, or so-and-so, Indiana, or so-and-so, Illinois? And everyone knows a community that fulfills the same role as Grant Saline. And so while I think there are concerns as far as are we sort of pegging Grant Saline as this racist town? I think for the most part, viewers walk away knowing this isn't just Grant Saline. This is a problem in all of America. And there's a lot of small towns like this throughout America.
We haven't talked about Charles Moore, who is the guy who inspired this film. And we actually have a clip of something his high school friend, Don Vickery, said about him. Let's take a listen to that.
Charles could have been anything he wanted to be. He was a bright, bright guy. And yet he saw fit to take up the cause of the minorities and to do good, do some good by sacrificing himself, so he thought.
That's Don Vickery talking about his friend, Minister Charles Moore, who is the subject of this documentary, Man on Fire. James Chase Sanchez and Joel Fendelman are in studio with me. They're the two guys behind this. What else did you learn about Charles Moore in doing this? I mean, obviously someone who is going to set himself on fire, writes this long letter that he leaves saying this is why he's doing this. This is something he thought about very carefully. To contrast what you were thinking, James, and what people talked about immediately, like this is a crazy person.
And I get that when someone first hears about this incident, a man sets himself on fire. Oh, he must have been crazy. And I mean, that's my first reaction when I hear about someone self-immolating in the States. But once you dive in a little bit deeper and you start to explore, it's like you said, this was a very deliberate act. He spent years thinking about this. He had a lifelong history of civil rights activism.
Including in Chicago. Moving his family to the west side of Chicago in the 60s. Mm-hmm.
And so when you put that all into context, James and I both walk away from this thinking this was a very thought out act. And to call him crazy, I mean, I think we both see as a way of not dealing with why he did this.
When you study his life, you see that he was so dedicated to civil rights, to the detriment of his family. I think one of the things that really stood out that didn't make it into the film is that Charles Moore did a, I think it was about a 15-day hunger strike in the mid-90s to protest the Methodist Church's stance on LGBTQ people in the community.
Something that's been in the news lately as well.
And he got them to change their policy from actively taking a negative stance to just having really no stance, saying that everyone it's accepted under the grace of God. And I think that's something that to me is this microcosm of this one thing he did that really shows everything that Charles Moore stood for his entire life. So when you study his life, I think you see what he chose to do to end his life, and you're not really surprised anymore.
There's so many questions that this film leaves you with afterwards. And I wonder, after the experience of doing this, what questions or what did this leave you guys thinking about?
We look at Grand Saline, we look at East Texas, and it's so easy to point the finger at the people in East Texas and say, well, those people, they're in the past. They haven't modernized their way of thinking. They're not enlightened in any way. And those people over there. But how can we ask the question of, well, what part of Grand Saline is in my community, in my town, in my family, in me? And that's the deep question I always want people to walk away with.
I mean, there's a question that one woman says, or an opinion she voices. She's like, how can I repent for what white people did years ago? And I think that's a question a lot of people ask.
Yeah, and I think that the problem is that if you just view this as a historical racist history and it's something that doesn't exist in the present, that's the way that you would walk away from this subject. But I think all research shows that, you know, racism post-civil rights is very institutionalized in so many communities, and it's easier for us to take defensive stances and say, this is something that passed. I don't have to repent for it. While not showing that we still have these same biases. We still uphold these systems of racism that are very present in most communities around America.
That's James Chase Sanchez, Joel Fendelman, and he are the guys behind Man on Fire. You can find this information online at manonfirefilm.com. As I said, it's also been distributed through PBS's Independent Lens. So check your local listings to see if it is airing on your local PBS station. James, Joel, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
With a season high total of 195.45, your UIC Flame.
With that announcement, the University of Illinois at Chicago women's gymnastics team wrapped up their last home meet ever after 40 years of competition. Back in the first week of the fall semester, UIC announced it would be ending both its women and men's gymnastics program, to the shock and disappointment of coaches and athletes. Despite the news, the UIC women went out with a bang, tying for first place as co-conference champions and missing a bid to regionals by just 1/100th of a point. We know about this because WBEZ Chicago, Kate McGee, has been following these athletes all season for the NPR member station in Chicago, where she's joining us now. Hi, Kate. Thanks for being with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So we were just playing some audio from your story. You did a great piece about this that we will tweet out. How did the athletes and coaches at USC find out that this would be their final season?
So it was the first week of the fall semester in August last year, and they were at practice Thursday night, and all of them got an email saying to come to a meeting the next morning, and no one knew what was happening or what the email or what the meeting was going to be about. The coaches and students were a little confused, but they all showed up the next morning. The coaches were there a little bit earlier than the students. And the coaches got the news first that the 2018-2019 season would be the last one, that UIC was going to cut the program. And the students were told 30 minutes later that this was their last year as gymnasts at the school.
Wow. And so what were the students told, if any of them were on scholarship, about how that would work and those sorts of things, Kate?
So the ones with scholarships, which is not that many, the number of scholarships has declined over the years for the gymnastics program. They would be able to keep their scholarship through the remainder of their time at UIC, which was a good news for some of them. But many of them were not on scholarships. And in fact, on the men's team, two students actually immediately transferred to different schools to continue their gymnastics competition instead of staying at UIC. So it was kind of a mixed bag of emotions friends for a lot of the students, especially for the freshmen who had just gotten on campus 1 or 2 weeks prior to learning this news coming for the gymnastics program. I was told from all the students it was a very emotional and kind of heartbreaking meeting.
And to that point, one woman who wasn't in the room was senior Mickey Northern. She was diagnosed with thyroid cancer earlier that summer, and she was recovering from surgery when the meeting was held. And I wondered if we can play a little bit of audio from your reporting. This is UIC athlete Mickey Northern speaking to Kate McGee from WBEZ when she found out that the program was ending.
I reacted worse to the program getting shut down than I did to finding out that I had cancer, which is weird to most people, but it's like just because I've had surgeries in the past. And I was like, you know, if this is what I have to do, then I can get past it. Like, this is something that was handed to me. Like, I can work with it. But the program, I was like, I don't know what we can do. There were so many questions in the air.
That's WBEZ Chicago's reporting. Kate, wow. I mean, I think that probably really says it all in terms of her sentiments. I wonder, did you hear similar sentiments from other folks?
Definitely. I mean, I think everyone was completely shocked and heartbroken. You know, gymnastics is this very intensive sport where most students, many of these students have been competing or practicing since they were 3 or 4 years old. And you spend hours in a gym. Many of these students have had, like, it's not just the time commitment, it's the physical commitment. I mean, many of them have said that they were like 9 years old getting elbow surgery.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have people in my family who are doing this, and it's like 9-year-olds, 5 hours a day, and they're practicing.
Yeah, I think one student said that growing up, there was no gym near her house, so her grandmother would drive her 40 minutes one way just to go to practice every single day for 4 hours since she was like 4 years old. So they're, you know, physically, and they, like, I tweeted out, or I on Facebook when I shared this story, like, spending time with these women, I have never felt so lazy in my life, of like how athletic and impressive they are, and the things that they can do in the gym were just, it was amazing. And they would do them so casually, just kind of like flipping all over the place. It was really an enjoyable time to spend with them. So they were all, I mean, this is their lives, and they've really committed a lot of their life to this sport. And so being told not only that this would be their last season, but being told so suddenly, and many of them felt like there wasn't a really good explanation as to why. Many of them said to me, you know, I feel like my life's work has been ripped away from me without any kind of notice or explanation.
And so I want to get to that why in just a minute, Kate, but I wanted to just play some more audio. This is junior Maddie Nowak speaking to Kate about this.
Our goal this season is almost like normalcy. And to be honest, that's what it feels like every day in the gym. It doesn't feel like this is going to be my last season.
Hi, Maddie.
Honestly, it hits me most on those days where I have a good meet or if I have like a great practice, because those are the days I go home satisfied, yet disappointed, because I try to imagine myself at this point next year and realize that I most likely will not be competing.
That audio from WBEZ Chicago. We're speaking with reporter Kate McGee about the UIC women's and men's gymnastics programs that have now been cut. So, Kate, how did the season go for these athletes?
So the women's team did really well this season. They won 10 of their 12 regular season meets. And this is something that the coaches said that they weren't really surprised by, because they had been working and to recruit and really build a really strong team since for the past few years. And they actually had 2 years of recruiting classes already kind of lined up, and they were really looking forward to the future of this program. And so the students did really well. They made it, you know, tied for first in their conference championship this past weekend, and were really happy with how they were doing. They felt like they were coming together as a team and, you know, kind of uniting in the face of this really disappointing news. And so it was a really kind of athletically successful season for all of them.
Kate, you also had a chance to speak with longtime coaches who are a husband and wife duo, Mary and Peter Jansen. I wonder their reaction to all of this, too.
Yeah, so they have been there for about 30 years. They came in 1990. They were both actually at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and where Peter was coaching, and that's how they met there. And I think they would agree with me in that this was their baby, this team. Like, they had been there for so long. They built this team up over the years that when they got there, the team did not have a winning record. It was not a great sport. It wasn't doing well. And They brought the team to regionals 9 times over that year, over that time span. In the hallway at the gym at UIC, there are these huge kind of team photos going back decades. And so you can kind of see them kind of throughout their time, kind of aging with the teams and how long they've been there and how much they've committed to this program. And since, you know, as I mentioned before, they found out that Friday morning with the students, and they were equally as shocked and heartbroken that this was going to be the last season for them, something that they had worked so hard to build.
So let's get to the why. Kate, we did reach out to UIC to try to get them to come on the 21st today. We did not hear back from them. What did you hear from them about, or what did you learn about why they chose to cut this program?
So I didn't hear a lot. They also would not talk to me for the story or answer written questions. They really would point only to this written announcement that they put out in August when they formally announced they were cutting gymnastics. And they've said very little about the decision publicly since then. Their argument basically is that they don't have the resources to provide a world-class kind of student-athlete experience for all the athletic programs at the school. And so they had outside consultants review the programs that they have, and they were actually weighing whether to cut track, swimming, or gymnastics. And this consultant report came down to that gymnastics would be the best program to cut because it costs the most money, and that money could be better used to improve the student-athlete experience for the rest of the program at UIC and to enhance the other athletic programs elsewhere. But beyond that consultant report that we got through a Freedom of Information request and the letter publicly that they sent out, they have said very little about how they came to this decision and why.
Let's bring someone else into this conversation. Dave Ridpath is also on the line with us. He's an associate professor of sports management at Ohio University, where he teaches about intercollegiate athletics. Hi, Dave. Thanks for being with us as well.
Well, fantastic to be on. Thank you very much.
Dave, was you listening? You've been listening into this. Is this a surprising story for you to hear for the way that a college would cut a sports program?
Well, I mean, first off, sounds like, you know, excellent reporting, and it was fascinating listening to this, but also following this story. And I just had a smile on my face because it's the same thing, different school. And what you're seeing here, it's just it's so humorous when you hear essentially what I would call coded language. When you have a school like UIC saying, we want to provide a world-class experience for the rest of our athletes, what they're really saying is we want to try to get better in one or two sports. For a UIC, it means probably men's basketball, so we can somehow make ourselves a more prominent university, which is largely a myth that would even happen. And we're going to do that at the expense of other teams. What UIC can do, they can provide a UIC experience. They cannot provide a world-class experience. They cannot provide what Champaign-Urbana provides. They cannot provide what Northwestern provides. And they shouldn't try to be that, because trying to be that is what a lot of schools have tried to do all over this country. And Title IX is not an issue. When you talk about Title IX of balancing gender equity and finances and treatment, Title IX is not the issue. Dropping sports is a choice. In fact, most programs that you see in college athletics right now had dozens more programs back before all these TV contracts and other things. What we're doing now at schools like UIC is we're overpaying basketball coaches. We're giving some students an experience well beyond what they should be having as a UIC student, and trying to capitalize on this winner-take-all market of, is, oh my gosh, if we're the next Loyola of Chicago, that's going to be this huge panacea for the school.
Right. I mean, there's no coincidence that we're having this conversation during March Madness, Dave, right? So how much of this is a mentality with universities that they have to put everything into a sport because they think that's going to be the moneymaker? Is that kind of the prevailing mentality among collegiate sports right now?
I mean, that's exactly what's happening. You have what is called, again, largely a myth, the front porch theory. And you see things like Loyola and like Sister Jean last year, and schools think, oh my gosh, here's a small school that essentially, you know, caught lightning in a bottle, and congratulations to them. But even with the gains and everything that Loyola of Chicago maybe made, they gave their coach a huge raise, they've done all these things and facilities and other things, that's going to offset any gains maybe that they've gotten. But schools believe that athletics is the clearest and cleanest window that people see a university. And in some ways, there is some merit to that. But at the end of the day, it is not the main reason for a university to exist. And not everybody is going to have success like a Loyola, but all schools think that they should strive for that, so they put whatever resources they can. Spending on male sports, football and men's basketball, has gone up almost 500% since Title IX was started to be enforced in college athletics. So this is not a Title IX
issue. Right, so there are people who are listening thinking, yeah, oh, they're putting money into women's sports, that's why they had to cut this. But you're saying this, that doesn't have anything to do with this, is what you're saying, Dave.
The bottom line is it's a choice, and the money is there if we choose to use it. And schools like UIC need to try to be UIC and stay in their lane and not try to be something they're not. But they get what I would call Loyola of Chicago envy, and they think that they can do it. And the ability to do that is really few and far between, and oftentimes it's a lot of luck to where it happens. And schools have to realize that they can't put all their eggs in one basket, because college athletics is supposed to be about participation, about the sound mind and body, and giving teams like gymnastics and others a chance. And the big worry is, as we continue to cut teams like this, this is the primary feeder system for our international teams, national teams, and other things like that. But as we continue just to focus on football and men's basketball, what's going to happen to the rest of sports development in America?
Dave, I also wanted to ask you just about the philosophy, just the counter to this, right, is you're saying college sports should be about the athlete. It should be about all of these other things you're talking about. But the money part of this is that a lot of universities feel like their fundraising and their ability to fundraise and their ability to especially fundraise from alumni is tied to men's basketball and men's football.
I think, again, that's largely a stretch. And what I would say is if we ran college athletics the way that it should be, the way that we claim the things that we supposedly care about, you know, the athlete going to class and learning and getting a degree and playing for good old State U, when it's really become a commercialized business about making a profit. Now, while alums and Subway alums, some people may really like it, those things would still happen if all the universities ran college athletics the way it was supposed to be. It's actually kind of this for-profit model that has put us in this area of where we want to win at all costs. And we don't care if the athletes can read or write. We don't care if they're getting bribed to go to that school. We just want to win.
Kate McGee has been with us as well from WBEZ Chicago, where she did this reporting about the UIC's women's gymnastics team, women's and men, the program now being cut. I wonder, you also talked to other universities throughout Illinois. What were other coaches throughout Illinois saying about this and the team at UIC?
So at the last home meet, which was against Northern Illinois University, before the meet started, the Northern Illinois team came over to UIC's team and kind of said to them, almost in solidarity of like, we love you guys, we, you know, are rooting for you this season, and gave them flowers before the meet started, which I think a lot of the students were trying to hold their emotions in already, and that really like put them over the line and everyone was crying. And I think it was this symbol of like, the students really felt for the teams at UIC because they see college athletic budgets tighten and universities have tight budgets. And I think there was this sense from other athletes like, this could have been us. And so throughout the year on social media and at the meets, teams have worn UIC gear. The team at UIC started this social media campaign where they used this hashtag Flip the Decision. And if you go on Instagram, you can see all these videos that college gymnastics programs across the country have made their own videos in support of UIC, kind of pushing for the school to change their mind and reinstate gymnastics. And so, you know, gymnastics was, the students were kind of like, yeah, this is a gymnastics community. We're very close. Everyone's really supportive. But it was really a sign to me that, you know, people felt, they felt for these students, and they know that, you know, next year it could be their program that gets cut for whatever reason. And so they wanted to show their support of gymnastics generally. There are only 60 Division I gymnastics program, college programs in the country right now, and that has gone down over the decades. And there are even fewer men's programs. So with each one that gets cut, there are fewer opportunities for students to kind of continue their gymnastics careers through college. And that's something I think they're all aware of.
That's Kate McGee. She's been following UIC's women's gymnastics team for WBEZ Chicago. We'll tweet out a link to her reporting and have it at our website as well. I also would like to thank David Ridpath for joining us. He's an associate professor of sports management at Ohio University. Kate, Dave, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
By the way, the end of the gymnastics program isn't the only news coming out of UIC today. Last week, more than 1,500 teaching assistants went on strike. over wages, health care, and rising student fees. So far, the Graduate Employees Union has said UIC is willing to negotiate over wages and health care, but will not discuss fees. That makes this day nine of a strike. Coming up, we're going to be looking at the origins of Illinois' only national forest, Shawnee. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There is one national forest in the state of Illinois, and it covers more than a quarter of a million acres across 14 counties in the southernmost portion of our state. One more stat for you. About a million people visit it every year. I'm talking about Shawnee National Forest. And if you haven't been there for hiking or camping, maybe you were there for the Great American Eclipse of 2017, where it was a great spot to see the total solar eclipse. This year, the Shawnee National Forest turns 80 years old. And to learn more about the story of this forest, we're joined by Molly Parker, a reporter with the Southern Illinoisan who's been writing about this. Hey, Molly, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me on again.
Also with us is Mary McCorvey, who's the Shawnee National Forest's Heritage Program Manager. Hi, Mary. Welcome
hey.
To the 21st. Good morning.
Thank you so much.
So, Mary, it's technically spring, and so I wonder what's spring look like in Shawnee National Forest right now?
It's really starting to green up a lot, which is really nice to see. But the classic thing that happens here in the Shawnee National Forest, and I don't know if you've ever heard this, but we are the only road, we manage the only road in the whole United States that is closed twice a year for amphibian and reptile migrations from their winter homes to their summer homes. This happens twice a year. And so it's a really pretty special place to go visit the Snake Road at this time of the year.
Oh, wow. So there's a lot of migration happening. Did you
oh,
say
yes.
snakes?
Oh, yes.
Ooh, I don't know that I want to see that.
Oh, no. It's really fascinating. And it's not like it's slithering like Indiana Jones, but it is. But they are definitely out and about.
So, Molly, you are a lifelong Southern Illinoisan. Do you have memories of the Shawnee National Forest from when you were growing up visiting?
I literally grew up at the edge of the forest. I would walk out and be in the forest. I grew up on Trick Tower Road in Simpson, and so I am a product of the forest. I'm a forest child. I grew up, that was our playground. My best friend Jess and I would roam out into the forest almost every Saturday and Sunday after church.
And Molly, what's your favorite time of year in Shawnee then? Do you have a favorite time of year?
Down, it's the fall. For me, I just say hands down the fall. What about you, Mary?
I like the summertime because I do like that so many people come down and visit during that time of the year. Yes, they come in the spring, and they definitely come for the fall colors. But summertime, we have so many special programs going on for school-age children that it's a really cool time to be down here.
I wonder if you can give us a little bit of a lesson here, Mary, because when we're thinking about the name Shawnee, I imagine like many names across Illinois, including Illinois, whether it's Peoria or Chicago, that's a Native American word?
It is. It refers to, of course, the Shawnee tribes that once roamed across here, although they didn't have a permanent residence here, even though there is a community on the Ohio River referred to as Shawnee Town. They were only in residence there for a very short period of time, literally like 4 years. And they came as a request of the French government at that time, back in the early 1700s, and they just were not comfortable at that location, so they left soon after that. But I think that's where the name comes from. The Shawnee National Forest was at one time two what they call purchase units. The Illini was on the west side of the forest, and the Shawnee was on the east side of the forest. And in 1939, they came together as the Shawnee National Forest.
And what time period are we talking about then when we had the Illini and the Shawnee that were residing outside there?
The Illini lived, and I should back up and say the Illini is a confederation of Indian tribes, and the Kaskaskia are the ones that actually deeded the land, their lands, to the federal government back in 1825. They had a reservation on the western side of the forest, or it wasn't a forest then. Well, it was a forest, but not the Shawnee National Forest, back in the early 1820s.
Were these tribes, I imagine, then forcibly moved? Where did they go?
They were not forcibly moved like what we consider the Trail of Tears. And I know this sounds very simplistic, but they did not enjoy living here anymore, and they removed themselves. And I'm talking about the Illini and the Kaskaskia right now. The Shawnee actually were forcibly removed at a later date in like the 1930s. Both tribes were feeling the pressure of Euro-American colonization as it moved westward, and they wanted relief from that constant turmoil and constant warfare that had been going on. They moved into Missouri relatively early, and again, I'm talking about this late 1700s, early 1800s, and they finally removed farther west in the 1830s, and then finally came to rest in Oklahoma much at a later date than that.
Wow. Okay, so we're really talking about pretty far back in American history. We're talking with Mary McCorvey, who's the Heritage Program Manager at Shawnee National Forest, and Molly Parker, who's been writing about Shawnee National Forest for the Southern as the forest turns 80 years old. And I wonder if we can speed up our history, Mary, to the founding of the forest. So what was going on after the native populations that were there were no longer, when we're thinking about the beginning of the last century, like the early 1900s, the 20s, 30s, what was Southern Illinois and what was that part of the state like then?
It's a really complex situation just because of things that were going on across the globe, really. The United States was an active participant in World War I, and because the farmers in Europe could not produce the grains that they had been to feed their European populations, the U.S. stepped up to fill that void with food. When the European farmers came back to their farms and began to produce crops again to feed the populations, the U.S. farmers were continuing to farm and grow crops at an amazing rate. And in fact, there was too much food here in the U.S., and it really literally went to waste. And that kind of spiraled the rural areas of the United States into a depression much sooner than what we always think. We always think of the Great Depression starting in 1929. Mm-hmm. But in fact, places like Southern Illinois, it started at least a decade earlier.
And so that brings us to a gentleman named Lindolph Oscar Trigg, or L.O. Trigg. Molly, who was he?
Colonel Trigg was a newspaper editor in his role in starting the Shawnee Forest, getting it proclaimed a national forest here, and he was concerned about the things Mary was talking about, the plight of Southern Illinois. And I think that's why I called this, it's really, you know, there were these patterns going on in other parts of the country, but to me, such a uniquely Southern Illinois story in that a lot of the things we were talking about, the economy and the desire to grow tourism and to backfill, you know, the jobs as the farming community flees, are things we're still talking about today, you know, almost 100 years later. And so he sought to create a way forward for the region and a visionary in his times. I didn't know all that about Colonel Trigg. I'm assuming he's even named after the road I lived on as a child. This was a name for him there at Trigg Tower. But just a fascinating individual who wanted to see a way forward for Southern Illinois.
Mary, why then? So we've heard a little bit, I guess, about the why he wanted to do this. How did he lobby the U.S. Forest Service to establish a national forest?
Well, he started with something called the Trigg Tours. He invited all kinds of movers and shakers in local government, county government, state and federal government, as well as national forest officials, and he would invite these folks on what he called a Trigg Tour, which involved every year picking an area of what would later become the forest and other interesting parts of Southern Illinois. He would invite these folks together, and they would go camping for a week, with camping out in the open or just all kinds of different places. And they just moved all around the forest in the next, between 1930 and 1949, when he passed away. They would have these annual meetings, and it was just a way to demonstrate to these guys who could make a difference, these movers and shakers, that there was tourism potential in all these natural areas that we have that are so beautiful, like Garden of the Gods, Bellsmith Springs, as well as the areas of historical interest like the stone forts of Southern Illinois, which are a prehistoric phenomenon that exists only here in Southern Illinois.
It sounds like it was like a lobbying campaign, essentially. Molly, is it President Roosevelt who officially declares the forest?
Right, and as Mary was explaining before, there were the two purchase units, and a lot of the work began years earlier with those two purchase units, plus part of the Dixon Springs property, were declared the Shawnee National Forest officially by proclamation in 1939.
Mary, it seems kind of odd because I would just think, oh, there was a forest and they declared it a national forest and then they said this was part of it. But they actually, this actually had to kind of be purchased and in a way built, right?
Oh, definitely. What you see today is not anything what it looked like back in the 1930s when the Forest Service helped with the establishment of about, oh gosh, I guess 11 or 12 civilian conservation camps scattered across southern Illinois. These guys are the ones that actually built, if you want to call it that, constructed the forest by collecting seeds and planting nurseries and then taking the nursery stock and planting it in the forest in these old farm fields. It's an amazing story.
They did actually sort of grow. I guess it sounds like they kind of created an area and then grew a forest within that area from things that were around?
Yes. Yes, exactly. What you see today is if you were... The area had been so farmed out because it's not really land. If you visited southern Illinois, you know that it's fairly hilly, and it's not really conducive to row crops. But that's what farmers were going at that time. And we had a number of initiatives that were ongoing here in southern Illinois, including Dixon Springs Agricultural Station, that was really trying to teach the farmers how to grow crops on hill lands. That was a big part of it. It was educating the public on soil preservation. But the other part was just simply saving the land that had been farmed over and cut over. We just were trying to save it and restore it into a usable forest where the government could actually grow trees. And that's what was going on with these, what we call pine plantation today. Those are all located in the old farm fields that are scattered around southern Illinois.
What kind of work goes into making sure that Shawnee National Forest is still maintained today?
Well, we're all about ecological restoration, and unfortunately, the forest is somewhat under attack by changing climate conditions. And I don't mean anything drastic, but forests are not a stable entity, and they have to be managed. Not only do our recreation areas have to be managed, but we have to care for the forest. We've had a number of traumatic weather incidents over the last several years, probably starting with the 1993 flood on the Mississippi. But we've also had a derecho in 2010. We've had a number of ice storms, you know, hit the forest really hard. And these kinds of things cause a lot of down timber that becomes a health issue for not only the forest, but for the people that reside around the forest. And the other thing that we absolutely need to do is, in order to maintain a healthy forest that we've got going on now, we need these oaks and hickories. The oaks and hickories are what feed the animals that live in the forest. And unfortunately, our forest is very, very slowly but surely changing from an oak-hickory forest to a beech and maple forest, which is a much more sterile environment and doesn't produce the foodstuffs that animals like the deer and the coyotes and the raccoons and all the critters that live in the forest that depend on for food. It just doesn't have that same nutrition for them.
So I wanted to just end by asking, and Molly, let me start with you. For folks who are listening who are maybe thinking about planning a trip to Shawnee this summer or maybe even this spring, what advice do you have for first-time visitors to the forest? Molly?
Yeah, well, it's a great opening for me to mention that the Tourism Bureau of Southernmost Illinois, which is a big part of the counties in the forest, covered by the forest, is hosting a trip tour on April 13th. And that is with the sort of a smaller version of the tours that currently trip-wide. And you can, you know, a little bit less roughhousing it in a shorter amount of time. I think it's just a day trip versus 3 days. So to me, that would be a great way. I'm hoping I can make that tour, where they're going to sort of recreate some of the places that he would have took the dignitaries into the forest. But the options are limitless. I mean, there's all kinds of things you can do in the forest. It's, you know, depends on your interest, whether you're into hiking, photographing, photography. You know, there's so many options. And I think the Shawnee has a website, and all of the tourism bureaus have multiple websites for things you can look up and find.
Mary, any advice for folks who are planning a visit?
I don't know that I can top what Molly shared with everybody. If you visit IllinoisOzarks.com, they have a number of itineraries that are available to you. Of course, everybody has to go to the Seed Garden of the Gods. It is our premier destination on the forest, and it was featured in the in the America the Beautiful coin a few years ago, and some people have probably picked these up as change, but seeing the camel rock from Garden of the Gods on that coin is pretty special. We have a number of camping areas on the forest that are available. It's like Molly said, it's an unlimited amount of things that you can do here on the forest if you choose to.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to speak with us. Mary McCorvey is the Heritage Program Manager at Shawnee National Forest. Molly Parker is a reporter with the Southern. Both of you, thanks for giving us some more information and context about the forest. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On Facebook, if you search for the 21st to like us, it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.